John Conradi with Connect Americans Now. We're a coalition that was founded in 2017 as a broad-based group of more than now 300 companies and organizations representing voices in agriculture, education, healthcare, veterans issues, technology, and small business, all committed to the shared mission of completely eliminating the digital divide in every American community. The purpose of this conversation today is to talk about both the ongoing impact of the broadband gap on a variety of facets of life and in every American community, urban and rural, and about solutions that Congress can advance to tackle this challenge, which is obviously timely both in the context of the immediate infrastructure conversation happening in Washington, and in terms of thinking about what comes next for tackling the digital divide after that infrastructure debate concludes. For folks who are joining as attendees of the webinar, we'd love to take some questions from you in the audience. If you can just use the chat feature of Microsoft Teams to submit your questions, I will pull out as many as possible when we get to the end of the webinar and ask those of our great panel, and we'll try to get through as many as we can. And so with that, I will just say that CAN, as an organization, advocates for a three-pronged approach to closing the broadband gap that includes deployment, so investments in physical infrastructure, to bring connectivity to currently unserved and underserved communities, adoption, so supporting the affordability of service and devices necessary for Americans to realize the full potential of broadband, and then investments in digital skilling, so programs and resources to ensure Americans have the skills needed to succeed in the 21st century digital economy. We have a great panel here with us today. We have Allison Rivera, the Executive Director of Government Affairs for the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. We have Chris Lagoni, Executive Director of the Indiana Small and Rural Schools Association. We have Heather Gate, Vice President of Digital Inclusion for Connected Nation, former Vice Chair of the Advisory Committee on Diversity and Digital Empowerment for the FCC. We have Kyle Zelby, who is the Director of Public Policy for the American Telemedicine Association, and we have Vicki Robinson, General Manager of the Microsoft Airband Initiative. Thank you so much to the panel for joining us. I'll now give each member of the panel just a couple of minutes to introduce themselves, their organization, and their interest in the issue of broadband connectivity, and we'll start with Allison.
Morning, everyone. Thanks for joining us. Thank you, John, for that introduction. Allison Rivera, Executive Director with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. And, you know, I think the biggest thing I wanted to get across today is there is such a need in rural America. That's where the members that I represent are working. They are small business owners. NCBA is the largest and oldest trade association representing over 250,000 cattle producers across the country. We have 44 state affiliates. So we have cattle everywhere, and they are in rural places across the country. And what I think we've learned through this pandemic is that these small business owners absolutely need connectivity, and not just connectivity, but strong connectivity in order to run their businesses. It's not just beautiful cows on beautiful green pastures that we all see pictures of. These are small business owners that need resources to be able to maintain that high level of sustainability and best practices that they have out on their farms and ranches. And in order to do that, in order to increase our technology, we absolutely have to have strong broadband. And another thing you're gonna hear from other people on this panel definitely affects my members and producers. You know, telehealth was very important during the pandemic, as well as educating these children in rural America, which you're definitely gonna hear about today. And then the things that I think maybe people haven't thought about is, you know, using our telehealth for our veterinarians to take care of our livestock during this last year. A lot of these issues we continue to try to bring to the forefront. I'm really glad that we could do this webinar today. Happy to be part of this this organization and this coalition, and look forward to a robust conversation today. Thanks, John.
Thanks so much, Allison. Chris?
Hi, I'm Chris Lagoni with Indiana Small and Rural Schools Association, but we are part of the National Rural Education Association. This was founded as the Department of Rural Education all the way back in 1907. It's a nonprofit focused on the interests of rural education all across the United States. We have almost 50 state chapters. It's made up of administrators, teachers, board members, committee members, even service agencies personnel. And we're very interested in the homework divide that is created by a lack of broadband access in rural areas. And we're excited to be a part of the conversation. Thanks.
Heather?
Thank you, John. And thank you, everyone, for participating in this important discussion. My name is Heather Gates. I'm the Vice President of Digital Inclusion with Connected Nation. And Connected Nation is a national nonprofit dedicated to improving lives and strengthening communities through increased access to and adoption to broadband and related technologies. And this year, we're proud to be celebrating our 20th anniversary of service. And over the last 20 years, our work has really been to help communities bridge the digital divide. And we've worked in over 30 states and one U.S. territory with projects that range from broadband mapping and planning to digital literacy training, device distribution, job skills training, and helping community anchor institutions tackle issues such as the homework gap. We have adopted a comprehensive strategy that allows us to help communities overcome issues that are related to infrastructure, which broadband access, adoption and use. And under access, we help states with broadband mapping, as I said before. As the nation's single largest grantee under the NTIA's State Broadband Initiative grant program, we manage broadband mapping and planning for 12 states and one U.S. territory, and processed over 54 million broadband records, representing 42% of the U.S. landmass. And under adoption, we help communities overcome barriers to adoption, and that includes implementing various programs that has resulted in over 80,000 people in Kentucky, Tennessee, and Ohio receiving training. We also have a program called Digital Works, which is a digital skills and job training program that we partner with vulnerable communities and veterans and veteran spouses. Most recently, we were proud to partner with AT&T and other organizations, including the NBA, to distribute over 35,000 hotspots to at-risk youth across 21 states. Our work on our ground in communities across the country helped us to develop an intimate understanding of the impact of lack of access and adoption. So accordingly, we're pleased to be part of this conversation as Congress works through the infrastructure bill. And we previously supported the Bipartisan Digital Equity Act and are elated to see that it'll be funded under this, could potentially be funded under the infrastructure bill. So thank you for this opportunity, and I look forward to a great conversation.
Thanks so much, Heather. Kyle?
Hi, I'm Kyle Zebley. I am the Vice President of Public Policy of the American Telemedicine Association. Really appreciate the opportunity to speak today. Obviously, for us, we see expanding access to broadband as part and parcel of our mission. And for us, we represent a diverse coalition of interested stakeholders in expanding virtual care. We know we cannot do that if we don't have broadband connections available for all Americans. And we're in a wonderful position as an industry and a community in that we have bipartisan supporters of both parties. We do that because I think that Republicans and Democrats alike, the Trump administration, the Biden administration alike, understand that you can't reach those underserved Americans without having virtual care as an option. So that's Americans in rural, suburban, and urban America. If we do not have access to broadband, we know that some Americans will simply lack access to care. And we think that everything we do at the ATA is an equity issue. We view it at that lens. And one of the things that COVID-19 has exposed is the huge disparities in health outcomes in this country. And so if we're going to expand access to care, which all parties say they want, we need to make sure that virtual care is an option. And again, if folks don't have access to broadband, they will lose access to all the various options available to them. And one of the things also that, COVID-19 has exposed is that broadband is a necessity for living your life in the 21st century. And so we applaud the administration and Congress for moving forward on the current bipartisan infrastructure package, which would include $65 billion in additional broadband investment. It's just an amazing first step. It's going to benefit Americans that want to have access to care and close all these other gaps, employment and education and otherwise, that are so crucial. So thank you again for the opportunity to be here.
Thanks, Kyle. Vicki?
Good morning, everyone, and thank you, John, for pulling this together. I'm Vicki Robinson, and I am the general manager for Microsoft's Airband Initiative, which is partnering with internet service providers and others to close the global digital divide. We have projects all over the world, including projects here that are extending broadband access and adoption in 33 states and territories. And so we're really excited about the opportunity here. A lot of people ask, why is Microsoft interested in this field and digital divide issues? And I will tell you, it's really core to our mission. Microsoft's mission is to empower every person and organization on the planet to achieve more. And we do this by empowering and leveraging the power of digital technologies. And this requires access to broadband. And so when you think about the work that I'm proud to lead from Microsoft, which is focused on increasing broadband access and adoption as a way to empower communities, this is where you really see our mission meeting the work, as we are working to ensure that people can access the power and unleash the power of broadband and technology in a way to improve lives. I'm so excited to be part of this panel. This has been work that I've been involved in for the past two decades. And so, like it's been alluded to by others, esteemed panelists, I'm waiting with bated breath to see what happens with the infrastructure bill and other work that is essential to really, it's a national imperative that we must take seriously the efforts to close the digital gap. And this is a once in a generation opportunity, and excited to be part of the conversation here today. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Vicki. And so several of you mentioned in your opening remarks the importance of broadband connectivity to achieving greater equity in American society. And so, Vicki, I'd like to just start with you. There was a report last week from the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies, and it found that in, according to the report, 38% of African Americans who live in rural communities in the American South do not have access to at-home broadband. So nearly 40% of African Americans living in those communities. And that compares to 23% of white Americans living in similar communities in the same regions who lack access. And so how does the digital divide deepen existing inequities in American society? And how can expanding access to broadband help build a more inclusive future with greater opportunities for all?
Thanks for that question, John. The reality is that the world's becoming more and more digitized. Right, the pandemic has only accelerated that rate of digitization as everything went online. We are literally participating on this panel online. School and learning went online. Telehealth went online. People are working online. All of this requires access to a reliable broadband internet connection. So if you don't have this, you are essentially being left out and unable to access essential services to really participate in the 21st century. Unfortunately, the figures that John shared are jaw-dropping. And we know that it's just the tip of the iceberg. We know that millions of people here in the United States, you can take the FCC's, what some believe to be kind of a conservative estimate that puts it at 14 million. We have other data to suggest that it's multiples of that. They are without broadband and not connected, and as essentially they are being left behind. And as you mentioned, John, this issue is particularly acute for racial and ethnic minorities who are being left out of and left behind. So my position and our position here, I think, of all the speakers, is that we have to do more to ensure that everyone has access to not only affordable broadband services, but also the devices and skilling that are necessary to use those services in a meaningful way. This is, I believe, must be considered to be essential for 21st century infrastructure. And again, I'm happy to see that that's all of these things are in play in the legislation that is pending in, here at Congress. These are things that are needed to participate in the digital economy. And I believe that as we work to ensure that we are being inclusive, that closing the digital divide is an important component, an important and necessary component to ensure that everyone has access to opportunities that should be available to all of us.
Thanks, Vicki. Yeah, and you mentioned the challenges, particularly during the COVID-19 pandemic, facing educators and students. And so, Chris, I'd like to get your take, you know, as a result of the public health crisis. What kind of impact did that have on student learning? What kind of challenges did it present for educators? And then as the number of students who relied on virtual and digital tools increased, what kind of strain did that put on the ability to achieve greater educational outcomes?
Well, the first problem was making sure teachers had connectivity. You know, when the pandemic first happened, you know, teachers were, you know, maybe they didn't have a strong connectivity at home because they had connectivity at school. And the first difficulty with the pandemic was, well, you can't come to the school to connect. And so schools were scrambling, how do I ramp up my teacher who is going to be tasked with delivering instruction, making sure he or she has a strong enough connection that they can host a Teams meeting or Zoom or whatever tool they were going to connect with students. So that was the first issue. And then the second issue, of course, was helping students connect, and that had all sorts of successes and failures all across the nation. You know, ultimately, for academic growth to occur, students need feedback. And, you know, they can't just work independently. And that feedback needs to be responsive and timely. And basically, that's what it all boils down. And you'll hear me say that, is this feedback concept that, you know, ultimately the investment is making sure that no matter what, learning can keep going, because the student can't grow at the pace they need to grow unless that teacher is with them, connecting with them, and providing them rich feedback. We have all sorts of meta-analysis of research that focuses on that. So we are decelerating the rate of student growth with less connectivity. So that's basically what it really fundamentally boils down to. The investment helps us make sure that students grow and get constant feedback from their teachers, which did not occur, and there was a great deceleration of learning, and we're trying to figure out how to catch that up.
Thanks, Chris. Yeah, and Kyle, you referenced this in your opening remarks, but obviously the demand for telehealth also started alongside the demand for virtual learning during the pandemic. And a recent survey found that as many as 3 in 4 Americans now say they would like to use a telehealth service in the future. Can you talk a little bit about the importance of broadband for ensuring that Americans are able to access those telehealth tools? And then in particular, we often think about broadband in terms of physical connectivity, but can you add a little bit on the importance of access to devices that can support those telehealth services?
Absolutely. Telehealth definitely has had its moment over the last 18 months. I think that policymakers understood that they needed to do everything possible to remove regulatory barriers in order to ensure folks had access to care. Thus, telehealth was covered and reimbursed in a way by commercial payers and public payers in a way that had never been possible prior to the onset of the pandemic. And when people finally had access to it, they liked it, and they want to keep it. And they want to make sure those flexibilities don't go away. They want to make sure that, obviously within reason, a lot of these temporary measures are made permanent. And that's a huge part of our mission here at the ATA. there are ways to access virtual care without access to broadband, most notably audio only. And for us, as we think about, again, healthcare as an equity issue and an issue in terms of increasing access to care, then that is a that is something that is, you know, can be clinically appropriate, can be a way to get virtual care for those communities that might not have access to devices or broadband. But it is certainly limiting the individual from all sorts of other options of virtual care that they would have if they had access to broadband, if they had access to devices that could connect to broadband. And that's, of course, audiovisual care, synchronous audiovisual care. That's asynchronous care, oftentimes done through a web portal or chat-based interactions, but not exclusively limited to that. Also, there's a whole range of other asynchronous services, remote patient monitoring services, that can allow folks to stay in place in their home. We can start moving the hospital to the home in certain circumstances. If you're living with multiple comorbidities, non-communicable diseases, you can be sure to be attached to it. Basically, what COVID-19 has said is that the U.S. healthcare system can actually be updated to the 21st century world and can give options to patients to have access to clinically appropriate care where and when they need it. But one of the prerequisites for most varieties of telehealth is reliable broadband access and the ability to have devices that can maintain those the access to telehealth. And by the way, one of the really crucial pieces here, once we get these fundamentals taken care of, is doing the hard work of educating folks how they can access it, what it requires for them to navigate the technology. And we just can't leave folks behind. We just can't dust our hands off once we take care of these really necessary challenges and say, aha, we've solved it. No, the work continues. But there is a basic foundation that has to be taken care of. Broadband expansion is one of them. And that's why this bill is such an important step.
Thanks, Kyle. Heather, I wanted to raise, while we're on the subject of the pandemic, that Congress established and the FCC administered during the pandemic a program called the Emergency Broadband Benefit Fund. And the objective of this program was to help Americans who faced income insecurity as a result of the public health crisis maintain access to broadband service and maintain their financial ability to afford broadband service. Could you just talk a little bit about the importance of programs like that, and not just in response to the public health crisis, but the enormous interest we've seen in that program and its success, and why that then is so important to continue on a more permanent basis?
Yeah, thank you for that question, John. So one of the things that we've found when dealing with issues of a digital divide is that, as we mentioned before, lack of infrastructure is one thing, but adoption has also been a challenge that has existed as long as tackling the digital divide. And so when you think about adoption, what are those challenges? What are those barriers to broadband adoption? And over the period of time, the results of studies have been pretty consistent, is that affordability has been one of those barriers. So has awareness, and so has digital skills. And so the emergency broadband benefit really is critical because it not only helps to tackle the affordability barrier during the crisis, but it helps to tackle a problem that's existed as long as we've been fighting this fight. It's great to see that providers have stepped up to participate in the EBB challenge to make sure that people across the country have access to that program. But the bigger picture here is, who are these people that are not able to adopt program? And again, data has consistently shown us is that it's low-income households, it's communities of color, it is those people that live in rural areas. And so I think it is critical not only that we keep that program beyond the emergency period, but knowing that the infrastructure bill does have some language in there that allows that program to persist as a low-income broadband benefit is also critical and good news for us who really saw that that program as an opportunity that needs to persist beyond the challenge. And so when people don't have the access, particularly people that come from vulnerable communities, don't have the ability to adopt broadband, they are literally missing opportunities to participate in this economy that we're creating online, and also miss on the opportunity to access resources that are being deployed, not only via government, but e-commerce and the opportunity for entrepreneurship. And so that helps to further exacerbate socioeconomic challenges that have existed prior to even the internet. And so again, giving people the ability to adopt broadband actually helps us as a community as a whole, as we are able to deploy equal opportunities via internet access. So we're really pleased to see that we as the United States are moving towards really adopting and accepting the importance of affordability for broadband for all Americans.
Thanks so much, Heather. Another pandemic-related question, this time for Allison. There was a lot of coverage during the public health crisis, and there continues to be in various industries and sectors about supply chain shortages. That included America's food-producing economy. How can action from Congress to expand connectivity and ensure access to broadband-enabled tools for agricultural producers help to safeguard our national food supply chain?
Great question, John. I think our producers every day in the ag space, and particularly in our industry, are being asked to do more, more sustainability, feed the world. That's a heavy task, but one we are very happy to take on. And what we saw through the pandemic, when we talk supply chain, that covers a whole lot of issues in our space. And a lot of the business that we do to make sure that the supply chain continues to move, we move a lot of cattle every day, and things even just like setting up deliveries and making sure that we have haulers that are ready to go, ready to show up at sale barns to pick up cattle. All of these things kind of fit into that supply chain, and all of these things are done online. And all of these things are done very quickly. All the financial information that my producers need to be able to know in a very timely fashion in order to make those business decisions so that the speed of commerce continues, right? That commerce is not gonna wait just because a producer doesn't have a strong connection that day. And unfortunately, that's a lot of the things that I hear from my producers. We buy and sell a lot of cattle online. This is part of our business model, and this is how our producers stay in business. And I think one of the struggles that we saw during COVID, there were a lot of issues that I think came to light, but just making sure that we have those strong connections so that we can continue to maintain the best business that we continue to do. I think that my producers, they did a lot to try to make things work. Introducing a lot of them to Zoom for the first time has been it's been great, but it's such a great thing when we can have these conversations across the country and everything works and we have a strong internet connection. And again, we're going to continue these supply chain conversations with USDA. This is so important because at the end of the day, my producers are trying to feed the U.S. and feed the world, and that's what they want to continue to be able to do.
Thanks so much, Allison. Vicki, I wanted to touch on some of the Airband initiatives work in assembling public-private partnerships to address digital challenges. And I know that that's included work both with internet providers on physical deployment projects, as well as partnerships with entities like the University of Michigan and the City of Detroit on affordability issues. Can you just share a little bit of background about these Airband efforts, and then also where you view the role of the private sector fitting into the role of public entities and policymakers in this space?
Absolutely, John. Well, partnerships, as you alluded to, are really the core and central to Airband. Microsoft itself is not becoming an internet service provider, nor do we intend to, but we recognize both from a business perspective, but also just from a matter of being a corporate social responsibility, that there is a role for us and for everyone really to roll up their sleeves and get this work done to close the digital divide once and for all. This effort, if we are to actually get it done, it requires all hands on deck. It's not something that can just be done, I think, by the government or people in the public sector. And it's certainly not something that could be done by the private sector alone. It's going to require everyone to come together, pulling together their unique resources and capabilities to bring assets to bear to close this problem once and for all. If you think about sort of the profile of our typical internet service provider partner from in the Microsoft Airband Initiative, they are in rural America. They are in cities, and they are oftentimes dependent on not just Microsoft investment and support, but absolutely leveraging federal and state funding that's essential to scale and drive in these communities. And so Heather mentioned about the emergency broadband benefit program. That's been a game changer for our partners as they think about what they can bring from Microsoft and the federal government and others to ensure that everyone has not just broadband access, but they can actually adopt it and take on the service. And so I think it's a best practice really when you think about what's needed to close the digital divide. You have public and private entities working together. You mentioned one of our partnerships with the University of Michigan. I'm really excited about this. Airband has historically, and it's not a long history, but when we launched 4 years ago, we were very much focused on work that we can do in rural communities to close the broadband divide, which is incredibly important. But we also know that there's an adoption gap in urban centers, right? And then ultimately in rural centers as well. And so when we think about working with an entity like the University of Michigan and leveraging their expertise around data science, they are literally going to be working with us to analyze at a very specific granular level how the digital divide presents itself in Detroit. And it's not going to be the challenges will not be the same in my hometown of Milwaukee or my adopted hometown of Bowie, Maryland. It's always a bit different, and so it's important to have that data to inform policies that can address and provide suggestions around how you actually close a divide in a very specific way for this that city in that instance. And so as I think about this work, it can't be done by the private sector alone, and it certainly can't be done by the public sector. You need both and all hands on deck if we are willing to close the global digital divide once and for all, which I hope we are.
Great, thanks, Vicki. Yeah, and Chris, there's some risk, right, that as we emerge from the public health crisis or eventually emerge from the public health crisis, that some of the focus, attention, and intensity on this issue could wane. Can you just talk a little bit about why it's so important, especially from the perspective of the homework gap, and then something you said that was really interesting, that it, also educators themselves, the teachers having connectivity, why it's so critical that this be, that policymakers focus on permanent solutions and not just temporary solutions responding to the current emergency?
Well, impact aid has been something that the federal government has provided to rural schools to kind of help with their purchasing power, and that sort of offset if they lost land due to the federal government, and they kind of affect their assessed value, which goes back to their local support and their ability to buy devices or purchase broadband connectivity. And that impact aid's been dropping for a lot of years. But all the way back to 1965, the Elementary and Secondary Act was focused on the federal government's role in equal access. And there's two variables the school district really can't control. They can't control the density of their population. They can't control their assessed value of the land within the district, which are kind of part and parcel with their ability to purchase goods and services. And so, you know, what the other speakers kind of hit on is this equity and access issue that long term, if we can figure out the backbone and get the fiber backbone to these rural areas, I think we can figure out the public-private partnerships for that last mile of connectivity, what that could look like. You know, in my state, Purdue University did a study, and it found that for every $1 invested by our state, there was a $4 return on investments in rural broadband. That's a pretty high ROI. And so your point, John, if we find some long-term sustainable fiber-in-the-ground solutions as a backbone for rural areas, I think that the U.S. will see a really big impact on the return on investment
from an economic end, from an education end, from job training end for adults. The list is endless.
Thanks so much. Yeah, and I, similar question. There were also programs dedicated specifically to telehealth advanced through COVID relief packages like the CARES Act. There's a connected care pilot at the FCC. Can you talk a little bit about the experience with those programs, how they've demonstrated that these sorts of programs can work or are important, and what that tells us about informing policy going forward?
Yeah, thank you so much. So absolutely, yeah, we saw a number of measures taken either through executive action or through legislative action, such as the FCC's COVID-19 telehealth program that did provide direct reimbursement to healthcare systems for investing in virtual infrastructure. We thought that was wonderful. It went through two different phases. Alas, even though we were talking about $500 million roughly, for instance, on the FCC's COVID-19 telehealth program, it's really a drop in the bucket compared to the need. We would really love to see an expanded investment to make sure that healthcare systems, obviously in particular rural healthcare systems, have access to the virtual technology that's necessary to bring access to care to more Americans. Also done by either executive action or in coordination with Congress through the public health emergency were a variety of waivers that really brought down those regulatory pinch points that had been really insurmountable hurdles towards having, for instance, in the Medicare program, coverage and reimbursement for most Americans and most Medicare beneficiaries. And so we are seeking, and there are bills right now to do this, to make those flexibilities permanent. We know that we've had a really supportive administration. We know that we have broad bipartisan support in both chambers. One of the main bills that would do that and also ensure that federally qualified health centers and rural health clinics continue to be able to cover and be reimbursed for telehealth services to their patients. One of the major bills to do that, the Connect for Health Act, now actually has 60 co-sponsors in the Senate, 30 Republicans, 30 Democrats. It's filibuster-proof. And that would be a wonderful step for Congress to take after securing this broadband investment in order to make sure that folks have access to virtual care at the end of the public health emergency, as we look towards making telehealth a permanent service that's not just applicable to COVID times. It's certainly something that should be permanently available post-pandemic.
Great. Thanks, Kyle. Yeah. And then, Heather, I also want to talk a little bit about, you know, there's also can be a tendency to think about, well, once we get not only physical infrastructure somewhere and set up programs to ensure affordability, that's it, digital divide tackled. Can you talk a little bit about the kind of educational career opportunities that can be denied to Americans who don't have the skills necessary to participate in the 21st century digital economy, and some of the ways we can help ensure Americans have access to those skills?
Thank you, John, for that question. The first thing that we'd like to make clear that the issue of digital divide or digital inclusion is not a binary issue. It is not just an issue of have or have nots. And so it's not an issue of have infrastructure and have device or have not. It is a more complex and nuanced issue, which also entails issues of digital readiness, digital skills training, and the application, the use of applications, such as the ones that we're talking about here, like telehealth. And because at the end of the day, what does success look like when it comes to digital inclusion? It does not look like infrastructure, nuts and bolts. It looks like people being able to get on and access telehealth, kids being able to get into to learn, and you know, entrepreneurship. And so that's the first thing. It's not an issue of haves and not nots. Now, failure to have access, which is meaningful access, right? It's a lot of times I always like to tell the story of when I part of my experience was actually going into classrooms and talking to people about the digital divide. And the first question I say, who's using the internet? And everybody puts their hand up. I know how to get to Facebook. Does anyone who knows how to
access your local government, the number of hands that go up, get less and less education, things that we take for granted because we use it every day. And that is meaningful use. And so when people are not using it meaningfully, then we're missing the opportunity for them to participate, right, in all the available programs that Microsoft and everybody else is providing. And so I think when it comes to tackling the digital divide, again, going back to the Digital Equity Act, one of the critical features of the Digital Equity Act is that it allows for competitive funding that goes to local community organizations that can customize and target things such as job training and training to use specific applications and a lot of other programs that are really granular. And as Vicky said, this is not a problem for just the government to solve. It takes a village. It takes the private sector stepping up and making sure that applications and tools that actually result to an economic opportunity are available. It takes local governments making sure that the policies are in place that people can actually adopt these opportunities. It takes anchor institutions, and these are the people at the front lines, including the schools, in providing these tools and services that allow students to participate. The interesting thing that I read most recently was a study conducted by a Harvard professor that says lack of digital equity means that women, minorities, and children that come from low-income households are missing opportunities for entrepreneurship. And that actually means that if those kids have access to technology, we can quadruple innovation in the United States. So let's talk about the missed opportunities, not only at an individual level, but for us as a country when everybody is not using the internet meaningfully. And so I think entrepreneurship, to answer your question, is a big miss for us when people don't have opportunities to access these electronic resources that are available at their fingertips.
Thanks so much, Heather. I'm going to ask one more question, and then I see we've started to get some audience questions. I want to make sure we save time to get to audience questions. As a reminder for folks, if you can please put your questions in the chat function, we'll try to get to as many as we can. But just quickly before we get to some audience questions, Allison, just going off of what Heather just said about innovation, you know, new digital tools are revolutionizing so much of our agricultural economy, including the livestock industry. Can you talk a little bit about how digital tools can help lead to better animal care, increased production, and increased opportunity, including, you know, for sustainable economic models for American producers?
Absolutely. And I see my friend Ben's question in the chat box as well. And yes, very pleased to see the $65 billion in there for broadband funding. You know, what could this do for cattle producers? You know, I think a lot of our producers will say, well, broadband is, it's that last mile situation for us, right? We are in very rural areas and is literally that last mile. I have producers tell me all the time that they live 10 miles from a major university and have terrible connectivity. And when we talk about how we're being asked to do so much more in the sustainability space, continuing to be the best stewards of the environment, precision agriculture continues to be something that is a huge part of our industry, and continuing to increase those best practices. Well, we're going to need connectivity to continue to do that. There's a lot of things in the cattle business that simply take that connectivity piece. I had a producer tell me recently that, you know, when she's in the cab of a tractor, she still needs to be able to do the daily business that is constant in our in cattle production. Not, you know, hop off the tractor, get in her truck, and drive back to the office. We need connectivity across our farms, across our ranches. And in a lot of cases, those are big spaces, and we absolutely need to be able to not only be the best stewards of the land, continue to improve our practices, which my producers are doing every single day, but we need that connectivity in order to do that, to remain at global, to remain competitive globally, which, again, we're killing it in that space, and my guys want to continue to do that. And in order to do that, they absolutely have to be able to have that high quality connection, not just dial up, but high speed internet. And I agree with everything that's been said on here. You know, in order for my producers to continue to maintain that high level in their business practices, they also need to be able to take care of their families at home. And we absolutely have policy in our policy book that addresses
all of the things that have been mentioned here today about telemedicine, rural healthcare, and just making sure that they have access to the things that they need in order to take care of their families and also take care of their businesses.
Thanks so much, Allison. Vicki, there's a great question in the chat about how do we balance considerations to want to make sure that folks who don't have access today get access to speeds that will hold up being able to support digital technologies going forward, while also balancing the need to try to connect as many Americans as possible. And we've seen this come up during the infrastructure debate. You know, there have been conversations about speeds of 100 symmetrical or 100 or 20, or should it just be meet the FCC's minimum definition of broadband? Can you offer a little bit about how you see kind of the importance of thinking about speeds in the mission of expanding broadband connectivity, and then anything else in terms of key principles that policymakers can keep in mind as they think about deployment dollars and setting aside money for physical infrastructure?
Happy to answer that question. I saw it in the chat as well. Just, you know, reflecting on my experience, not just at Microsoft for the past, you know, nearly 4 years, but working on these issues for the past 2 decades, one thing that's clear to me is that there is no one solution that works for all communities. I think as a principal matter, and we certainly are doing this from a Microsoft Airband perspective, we embrace a toolkit approach, meaning use the best technology solutions that are going to work best in a given scenario for a given use case. So I think just kind of stepping back and not, you know, over-indexing on one particular solution is an important principle to apply here. I think the other thing that's kind of lurking in the background, and it kind of gets at a second question in the chat, is that we're talking about $65 billion that's potentially in play now, $40 billion of which I think is going to go towards access. One thing that keeps me up at night is that we don't really know the full scope of the problem. Those numbers are based on data that is at best incomplete, and then if you're a bit more uncharitable, you can say just wrong, right? And so if you're talking about $65 billion, policymakers need to be focused on what is going to be cost effective to ensure that everyone can get access. And so I think that's an important principle that should be applied. How do we use these monies to be targeted to areas that are truly unserved or underserved? How do we ensure that they can get access quickly? There should be a prioritization placed on technology that can be deployed quickly. And then we should do it in a cost-effective way, recognizing that the money is not endless. And again, we don't really fully understand the full scope of the gaps that exist here in the country, because there is work that's still outstanding with regard to broadband mapping, which we haven't really touched on here. So I think that those principles are important. I think we hear a lot about the need for symmetrical or gig services. I just think that that's not really kind of bearing out as you actually are going in rural America and places, and people are saying, how about, you know, can I get 10 megabits when I have none? And it's not to say that we should shortchange any place. We don't want to create a situation to have and have nots. We do need to be principled. We need to recognize that the first priority should be to reach everyone. And we, as policymakers, are thinking about this issue. They should be mindful that the money is not endless, and you have to deal with access, but also the adoption piece, which is critical as well, all from the same bucket, potentially.
Thanks so much, Vicki. Yeah, and just to add on to the couple of questions about details of the bipartisan infrastructure package, there's obviously been some public reporting of what it includes, and includes several items that are relevant and important to broadband that fall under that $65 billion. But like Vicki mentioned, the latest framework has about $42 billion dedicated to deployment, which would be administered by an agency in the Department of Commerce called NTIA, the National Telecommunications Information Administration, to distribute to state governments. And then there would be an additional about $11 billion to make permanent the Emergency Broadband Benefit Fund that we talked about a little earlier, and rename it as the Affordable Connectivity Program. There are several other important policies contained in the $65 billion, but those are kind of the two largest with the biggest impact. There's a question from Cheryl in the chat that I think, Heather, you might be able to speak to well. It's getting at the question of how do small ISPs, small providers, figure out how to get access to grants and public programs that exist to help expand connectivity. And so wondering if you might have any insights on that question.
I'm hoping that as the language in the broadband bill evolves, there may be more clarity on that for small businesses, for small providers. I think one of the big developments over the last year as a result of COVID has been quite a bit of funding after in the different bills, Appropriations Act and the Rescue Act have had different programs for small providers. So I think a good start is to become familiar with where your state, first of all, is as far as what their priorities are as far as broadband funding and what they're doing. That's always a good start. And then also determine who in your state is the broadband authority, whether it's the Economic Development Office or if there's a broadband office. That's a really, really good state. Another thing is just to pay attention to the different funding opportunities that are coming from multiple directions, because there's been this pretty aggressive approach to tackling this. And the good news in the past 3 months is that the Department of Commerce and the FCC and everybody else, they're starting to work together a little bit more. So I would say pay attention to the NTIA. They have multiple programs right now, some of which are closing within the next month. Those are opportunities. I would say also pay attention to FCC. The FCC, they have different types of opportunities that are coming through as with the different grant, with the different funding opportunities. So I would say, first of all, determine who your broadband authority is in your state. And that is who you need to have conversations with. Another thing is that we, with Connected Nation, we're working with counties, helping them develop community technology plans. And one of the things that we're realizing is that there is a big divide between providers and community leaders. And so I would say also start having those conversations, because one of the things that we do when we help communities develop community technology plans is ask them if they know their providers. Are they in conversations with their providers to see where providers have funding and where they're deploying infrastructure? It is very, very important to create those relationships and those networks. There may be opportunities for public-private partnerships to submit grant applications for funding, such as the infrastructure grant that the NTIA currently is accepting applications for. So there's a lot of money coming in all directions. So create relationships and determine which grants that you most qualify for. And that may entail creating partnerships with local communities.
Thanks, Heather. Vicky put a great flag in the chat that $65 billion framework also includes about $1 billion plus for digital skilling. We talked about several times during this event the importance of ensuring our skills necessary to utilize digital technology in addition to having access to broadband. I saw your hand raised. Did you have a point you wanted to add on to Heather's comments?
Yeah, I think it's going to be important for states to figure out how can we be transparent and make sure public dollars don't pay for redundant systems? You know, when ISPs get together, nobody wants to share their, you know, blueprint. But, you know, at the state level, as these dollars come to the state level, you may need someone at the state that says, okay, you don't have to share your blueprint publicly. But at the state level, if we're going to be doling out dollars, someone has to be looking and making sure we're not laying lines on top of lines and, you know, let's get the most bang for our buck. So I think there are going to be a lot of policy considerations at the state level as these dollars come down, you know, as efficient as we can be with that. And there's going to be some rubs because big ISPs don't like sometimes public-private partnerships that get scary. But we have to realize that there's business opportunities in selling network access to other smaller providers, and there's new markets to be developed. And, you know, if we're going to get to that last mile, it's going to take some new challenging paradigms of what it could look like. And it's exciting to hear what Vicky's doing. So it's that type of thing of as the money comes down, we've got to think about it in new ways.
Great. Thanks, Chris. I think we have time for one last question. It just came through. Vicki, I'll probably ask you to address this one. It's a question about the broadband mapping issue. Obviously, there's some great work done in the last Congress through the Broadband Data Act to try to begin tackling this challenge. But can you talk a little bit about that challenge that you referenced in terms of the national mapping of the digital divide and how it underestimates the scale of the challenge and can hamper public investments in tackling the challenge because we don't know exactly where folks do and do not have connectivity?
Absolutely, and I'll try to do this as quickly as possible, being mindful of time. So Microsoft has been really vocal about this issue because we think it's incredibly important to understand the scope of the problem. You can't fix a problem if you don't understand the scope of it. And so while the latest FCC data suggests that a little over 14 million people here in the United States lack broadband access, we have data that's usage data from Microsoft products and services. That is how these services are being accessed at broadband speeds that suggest that as many as 120 million people are not accessing broadband and internet speeds. That's an astounding figure. That means it's like roughly a third of the country. And so I'm sure that the answer lies somewhere between. And then you have broadband now with that data point of that puts it the figure at 42 million. And so from our perspective, recognizing that there is still work undone, the FCC has not yet implemented the Broadband Data Act that John mentioned. The question is, what do you do? So I think we can't take our foot off the gas in pushing for the FCC and to continue the very important work to actually map the gap. But in the meantime, we need to have that as top of mind when we're talking about dollars and how those dollars are allocated. And if you risk putting all, these dollars in one place and you declare victory only to find out, a year or so later that the gap is multiples. The question is, where does that leave us as a country? So it's super important that we continue that very necessary work to understand the full scope of the problem.
Thanks so much, Vicki. Thanks to our whole panel. We are at time. For all attendees, I would encourage you, please go to www.connectamericansnow.com to learn more about the coalition and our mission about solution to tackle the digital divide. If you're interested in learning more or the organization is interested in joining the coalition or participating in our efforts to help advocate for solutions to expand connectivity, please feel free to email me directly. My email is John, no H, J-O-N, at connectamericansnow.com. We so appreciate taking the time to join us to talk about this important issue.